From the book of Exodus, in chapter 20, verse 1. Book of Exodus, chapter 20, verse 1. And God spoke all these words. Book of Leviticus, in chapter 1, please. Now the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tabernacle of meeting. Book of Numbers, chapter 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai. And then our book. Book of Deuteronomy, please, chapter 1. Verse 1. These are the words which Moses spoke to all Israel on this side of the Jordan in the wilderness. Verse 5. On this side of the Jordan in the land of Moab, Moses began to explain this law, saying, chapter 4, please, and verse 37. Because he loved your fathers, therefore he chose their descendants after them. And he brought you out of Egypt with his presence, with his mighty power, driving out from before you nations greater and mightier than you, to bring you in, to give you their land as an inheritance, as it is this day. Therefore know this day and consider it in your heart, that the Lord himself is God in heaven above and on the earth beneath, there is no other. You shall, therefore, keep his statutes and his commandments, which I command you today. Chapter 15, please. Verse 1. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. Verse 7. If there is among you a poor man of your brethren, within any of the gates in your land which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart, nor shut your hand from your poor brother. But you shall open your hand wide to him, and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Beware, lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, the 7th year, the year of release is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry out to the Lord against you, and it becomes sin among you. You shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you, in all your works and in all to which you put your hand. For the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother to give to your poor and your needy in your land. If your brother, Hebrew man or Hebrew woman, is sold to you and serves you 6 years, then in the 7th year you shall let him go free from you. And when you send him away free from you, you shall not let him go away empty-handed. You shall supply him liberally from your flock, from your threshing floor, and from your winepress. From what the Lord has blessed you with, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore I command you this thing today. That's all I plan reading tonight from the Bible. That was the New King James Version. The scene is set in the land of Moab. The time is the brief interval between the end of the wilderness wanderings and the crossing of the Jordan. Israel was poised, as verse 8 of chapter 1 tells us, to go in and possess the land. That is the first of 52 references in this book, the word possess. They were going in to possess the land, but sadly, that didn't include Moses. A fact which he refers to four times in the course of his book. And in chapter 3, he records his very moving prayer. It was at the time when he first commissioned Joshua to take over. We're back in Numbers 27, and Moses revisits that, and he tells us of how he prayed. And he said to God, "Please, please let me go over and see the land." And the Lord replied very firmly, "That's enough. Don't mention it again." Very sad. In many ways, the book of Deuteronomy is one of the lesser known books of the Old Testament, at least it is to many of us. And yet, the teaching of the book of Deuteronomy is fundamental to the teaching of many of the Old Testament prophets. And no doubt gave impetus and direction to the last great reformation that the house of Judah ever knew under godly Josiah. The writers of the New Testament were certainly familiar with it. It's one of the four books most referred to in the New Testament. And I'm not going to read them to you, but I have listed over 80 quotations in the New Testament from this book. That's not bad going. And as you all know, this book furnished the Lord Jesus with all the ammunition he needed when, like Israel, he too had come to the end of his wilderness experience after a period of 40-something or others. Now, in some ways, the contents of the book of Deuteronomy, the contents differ from the revelation which God had given at Sinai, a point picked up by Moses, actually, at the beginning of chapter 29. There's a lot of material in the earlier revelation, which is omitted from the book, and there's a lot of information in the book, which wasn't part of the original revelation. And there are at least three ways in which these two differ. Deuteronomy differs from the books of Exodus and Leviticus, the revelation given there, in that the situation faced was different. And this book is suited perfectly, entirely, to the new circumstances, namely the conquest, the forthcoming conquest, and possession, occupation of the land of Canaan. So you read about the requirement that you have to destroy all the altars and images of the Canaanites. You're given building regulations to govern your house construction. You don't need that in the wilderness. You are told, for instance, to write the key elements of the law on your doorposts and gates. Whereas the equivalent in the book of Exodus in chapter 13, you're just told to bind them on your hands and between your eyes, which repeated in the book of Deuteronomy, but with the addition to the reference of the doorposts. The book of Deuteronomy differs from the previous revelation also in the target audience. Although priests and Levites do receive honorable mention in the book of Deuteronomy, they're only mentioned in connection with their rights and privileges. You don't read about their duties. You read nothing about the ritual, nothing about the sacrifices, nothing about the garments, nothing about the construction of a sanctuary, which litters the pages of the earlier books. But you focus instead upon the people in general. The word is for, dare I say, the common people, and not the religious leaders. It's what they need to know when they enter the land. And thirdly, it differs in the nature of the speeches themselves, which is why I read from other books. Both Exodus and Leviticus, and also Numbers, which is slightly less relevant, are made up of words spoken by God to Moses. Comes out like a rash. Every few chapters, the Lord spake to Moses. Don't find that in this book. This book, with the exception of a little bit at the end, is concerned with that which Moses spoke to the people. And in a sense, the book of Deuteronomy is a collection of sermons. Moses began to explain this law. So the New King James Version, rendered verse 5, the Authorized Version, says he declared, but it's not the usual word to declare. It only occurs three times in the Old Testament, and it means really to make something plain. And in the context of Deuteronomy, it refers to what we label today expository preaching. And that set, verse 5, sets the tone for the whole book. We read from chapter 15, and I read it for illustrative purposes only. It begins, verses 1 and 2, with a statement of the actual law. This is what you'd have found in a law code about the release of debts. But then he gets going as a preacher, and when you get to verse 7 down to verse 11, he's exhorting his congregation, the nation, to open their hands wide, not to refuse a loan on the ground that it's the sixth year, and next year they'll never get it back. That's effectively giving the money away. Just because the year of the cancellation of debts is drawing near, says Moses, no ground at all. You give, and you give liberally. It's the preacher. Now, as you would expect, the great Ten Commandments provided him with the main basis for his sermons of that more anon. And in his preaching, he's forever switching back and forth between addressing individuals personally and addressing the nation collectively. The Authorized Version, of course, observes that distinction between the thou shalt and the ye shall. And it's right, that's exactly how he did it. And he's whipping back and forth. Because any nation is made up of individuals and never rises above the spiritual tone of the individuals. And God is interested in both. So Moses addressed both. And throughout he places emphasis, quite remarkably, on the people's motives. He's not satisfied with what they do, but why they do it. God was looking for a grateful, willing, loving obedience. And there's this verse in chapter 28 which says, you don't need to worry about the context, because you did not serve the Lord your God joyfully and gladly in the time of prosperity. God wanted that. Moses looked for it. Moses stressed more than once that everything God had commanded, as he put it, if I can use his words, is for our good. Always. It's for our benefit. And it's one of the sad things that because of man's sinfulness, these very commandments which set out the way to live happy and satisfying life fuel, according to experience, fuel lust and legality. But it was not intended so. The structure of the messages of Moses and the book that we have, very familiar to him and to the people of his day. They follow the pattern of what were known and still are to scholars as vassal treaties. Now that's a bit technical. They were a common feature of international law of the day, and they were for about 2,000 years. They were drawn up when some great power conquered some smaller state or country and imposed conditions of service on them. Now, of particular interest to me tonight, and to you actually, is the treaties which came from the empire known as the Hittite Empire. Not to be confused, actually, with the Hittites of the book of Deuteronomy. You read about them now and again. They're just a small Canaanite clan or tribe, an ethnic group in Canaan. That's not the lot. I'm talking about the Hittites, the kingdom of Hatti, flourished for 1,000 years, based in central Turkey. For 2 centuries, the Hittites rivaled the Egyptians and Babylonians for world supremacy. Incredible that. On one occasion, they managed actually to bust into Babylon and loot the place. So they were one of the big fellas of ancient Near East. And the Hittite treaties tend to have common features. And those are they. Now the structure of the book of Deuteronomy is not line for line identical. But, having said that, step. But although we would not claim a perfect correspondence, the similarities are quite remarkable. Forget the Hittites for a moment. We know that the Egyptians also imposed similar treaties on their vassals, the countries that they'd overcome. And indeed, there is some evidence that treaties of roughly that kind were imposed by the Egyptians on foreign labor forces in Egypt at around the time of the Exodus, give or take a century or two. Now, quite obviously, Israel was a candidate for one. And as I understand it, God chose to adapt a familiar treaty format for his own purpose. He used it to express his relationship with his people, Israel. Now, the implication of that would have been clear to them immediately. But you may say to me, does the structure of Moses' speeches and the book of Deuteronomy actually matter? And I would say, well, certainly as far as I'm concerned, it does matter, and it matters a lot. Because the very structure declared plainly that the Lord had redeemed this people from the bond service of Egypt to become his bondservant. That's what the very structure was saying. That the people had exchanged the service of Pharaoh for the service of the Lord, the God of their fathers. And this point is made repeatedly by Moses throughout the book. He's constantly referring back to what Israel had been, and where Israel had been, and to their redemption by God's mighty power. And he employs in the book a standard formula. I'll quote it to you. You picked up one reference already to it. Remember that you were bond slaves in the land of Egypt. Therefore, I command you to do this. And that keeps cropping up in a variety of contexts. It was the motive in Deuteronomy 5 for keeping the Sabbath, not in the book of Exodus, but in Deuteronomy 5. It was the reason, in chapter 15, we read it, that the Israelites were to be generous to bond slaves who they had set free. It's given as the reason in chapter 16 why the nation should keep the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost as we came to know it. It's a reason in chapter 24 why people mustn't deprive the widows, orphans, and strangers of their rights. And also in chapter 24, it's the reason that the people were required to make positive provision for disadvantaged people like that. Remember that you were bond slaves in the land of Egypt, therefore I command you to do this. You have been redeemed, he is saying. And therefore, and we can't just duck out of that too quickly, we've also been saved to serve. It follows. As Paul put it to the Corinthians, concerning the Lord Jesus, he died for all, that those who live should not live no longer for themselves, but for him. Well, I'm going to use the structure that's on the board here. The headings based more or less on a typical vassal treaty to enable us to survey the contents of the book. Now, in the time that we have, I can hope really to give you no more than a taste of the book itself. I console myself with the knowledge that I can tie up any loose ends I have next week. First of all, we'll begin with the preamble. Hittite treaty began by identifying the author of the treaty and giving him his official title. This is Mesulis II here that we've got up here, who circulated a little later than the Exodus and made a right pain in the neck of himself as well. Moses,
These are the words which Moses spoke. But Moses makes it clear that this is different.
And in verse 3, he tells us that, I quote, he spoke according to all the Lord had given him. So I'm only a mediator, he's saying. This isn't my treaty. And if you want a date for my treaty, he says, it's the first of the 11th month of the 40th year. That is the 40th year from the new beginning, from the great Exodus event. And then he drops in verse 2, the fact that it was actually only 11 days' journey from Horeb or Sinai to Kadesh. And Moses is just wanting to point out to this generation that because of the unbelief and rebellion of the former generation, they had wasted 40 years. But that's the preamble. The historical review, or prologue, I suppose, technically. The first major section of a Hittite treaty rehearses the kind, I've got my tongue in my cheek here, but this is how they present it, the kind and benevolent actions of the great Hittite king toward his vassal, intended to move the vassal to feelings of gratitude and inspire him to devotion and loyalty. Didn't usually say very much about how he'd knocked the stuffing out of the country in advance. But it was a very vital element of the treaty, and as in the case of Deuteronomy, often ran to considerable length. Now for his part, Moses refers back. He refers back to God's promises and covenant with the fathers, with the patriarchs, which he tells us were out of love and reinforced by oath. He refers to the deliverance from Egypt, which he calls the iron furnace. That is a furnace for smelting iron. It was hot in Egypt, he's saying. He refers to the revelation of God's word and what a treasure it was and what a treasure he saw it to be at Sinai. He refers to God's sustaining care through the wilderness. That great and terrible wilderness, he says. He ought to have known he'd been there. And where, in spite of their perpetual perversity and sinfulness, they lacked nothing. That's chapter 2, verse 7. You lack nothing, he says. And finally, he points back to the recent victories which God had given his people over Sion, and that king from Bashan, who had been graced by his parents with the delightful name of Og. And you might like to notice in chapter 2, it's fascinating, references to giants. You remember that at Kadesh, it was the fear of giants which caused the rebellion following the report of the spies and landed Israel in this mess. And I find it significant that in chapter 2, Moses tells of three races of giants that had been destroyed by neighboring nations while Israel were wandering round aimlessly in the desert. And then in that first section, the first main section, he rams home the practical implications of all this with the word therefore, four times. It occurs in the Authorized Version in that section. I read one of those from chapter 4. He loved, he chose, he brought out. You shall therefore keep his statutes. In the light of God's goodness, the preacher exhorts his people to gratitude, obedience, loyalty. It's Moses' version, if you like, of Romans 12. It's the mercies of God. Present your body. General stipulations, chapters 5 to 11. At this stage on a Hittite treaty, you would have laid out for you the basis of the relationship between the two parties to the treaty. And usually, not always, but usually you would summarize the purpose of the specific, the detailed stipulations which followed later. This section of Deuteronomy begins
with the statement of the Ten Commandments. Moses calls it that. Not there, but elsewhere. The Ten Commandments. Well, you know how many there are. And he also fills you in on the circumstances in which those commandments were given. In chapter 5. Now, in the secular treaty, they always insisted that there would be no alliances, no treaties with other nations. And that's why I suggest this section of Deuteronomy concentrates mainly on the first two commandments, the bit about no other gods and no images, and warns continually against idolatry, which would constitute, Moses appeals to them, would constitute disloyalty and rebellion against the Lord. He is a jealous God, he says. He doesn't only say that in the Ten Commandments. Chapter 6, verse 14. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples around you. The Lord your God is a jealous God, and he's not going to tolerate treaties with other gods. If you follow, serve, and worship them, he says, then his anger will be aroused, which is language that comes from these treaties, and you will surely perish. And that's why they were to destroy utterly the Canaanites. Exterminate! Why? Because if you don't, then they'll turn you to idols and serving their images. And in this section, Moses provided them with some brief summaries of what was to come in the later section. So I'll just give you two examples. In chapter 10, verses 18 and 19, he said this concerning the Lord. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow. He loves the stranger, giving him food and clothing. Therefore, you love the stranger. And that sets the stage for a lot that we'll meet in chapters 12 to 26. And at the end of the section, this is the end of chapter 11, of course, verses 26 to 29, he refers to the blessing that would follow in the wake of obedience and the curse that would follow in the wake of disobedience, tells them that when they cross the Jordan and at Gerizim and Ebal, these things have to be recited. But it's not until, as you can see on the wall, until chapters 27 and 28, he comes back to that and fills in all the details. But you are getting summaries in that early stage. And in that section, great stress is placed upon the land to which they, but not he, were journeying now. And it would be a great place. And it would be theirs entirely by grace. It would be theirs by gift, not the result of their own efforts. They would enjoy cities they hadn't built, houses they hadn't stored, wells they hadn't dug, vineyards they hadn't planted. And the land to which they were going was not a demanding land, like the land of Egypt. In Egypt, as he observes, we had man-made irrigation systems. We were pulling in water from the Nile. It required effort. Continual operation. But when you get to that land, the new land, it will drink water from the rain of heaven. Water guaranteed by one who never takes his watchful eyes off it. It's a quote virtually from chapter 11, certainly a paraphrase of chapter 11. Nice place. Wish I was going there. But the land, he points out, was also fraught with danger. Possession of that land would bring its own temptations. Because the very prosperity, the fullness that they would enjoy when they reached Canaan would expose them to pride and self-sufficiency. The danger, I quote his words, that you forget the Lord, and you say in your heart, my own strength and power have gained me this wealth. What are you going to do about that then? Well, Moses says, your safeguard, your defense, lies mainly in your memory. You must be careful to remember, and you teach your children so they can teach their children, so you'll always remember as a nation the history of the Exodus. Your previous experience as bond slaves in Egypt. Keep that in front of you. Remember that all this is yours by gift. You didn't always have it. You came into it. This is grace. Or as Paul would say to the Ephesians, remember that you were one time Gentiles in the flesh. What was I? What would I be if he hadn't redeemed me? Don't you forget that, Moses said. Because when things go well with you, that's your defense. Let me come to the main section. Now, I dismissed it in two words over here. But as you can see, it's the bulk of the book. And it's a fascinating section. You discover what you need to do to make your house safe. You discover what to do in the case of an unsolved murder. No Hercule Poirot to solve your problems for you. What do you do? You discover what to do in the case of a kidnapping. What to do if you come across a bird's nest with a mother bird sitting on eggs or chicks. Some fascinating stuff in there. Many of the stipulations concerned the people's relationship, and put it this way, the vertical relationship with God. There's a lot about that. They were required to worship at the sanctuary, in the place where he set his name. They were not free to erect altars or offer sacrifices and offerings as and when they chose. They were forbidden to serve their God in the same way as the pagans served their gods. They were commanded to stone all idolaters in Israel, even if that was a near relative or a prophet. And there were some interesting prophets they were going to have. In chapter 13, he speaks of a prophet inviting you to go and serve other gods. And he speaks in the name of one of those gods. And what he says comes to pass. Don't believe him. Stone him. In chapter 18, if a prophet comes along and invites you to serve other gods, and he speaks in the name of the Lord, and it doesn't come to pass, then you don't believe him either, and you stone him. Fate same in all cases. Doesn't matter if it's your sister or brother or the false prophet. Concerned with relationship with God. But many of these stipulations are concerned with their relationship with others. The community of Israel was regarded by way of doctrine in this book, as a kind of large, extended family or household. They were, after all, the children of Israel. And one of the key words is the word brother. Everyone was reckoned as brother, whether rich or poor. And that's what you had in chapter 15. I don't know if you noticed it, but it's the brother who's poor, or the brother who's enslaved. And over 20 times you've got the brother this, and this brother. And every member of this community was dear to the Lord. And he was one of your brothers. And you look at him that way. Now we are, I was going to say blessed, I don't know where we are. We happen to possess today correspondence of roughly the time of the Exodus between Egypt and some of the states in Canaan and Syria. And what this correspondence shows is that the Canaanites were characterized by injustice, greed, lying, theft, drunkenness, prostitution, child sacrifice, and so on. Not a nice bunch of people. And indeed elsewhere in the ancient Near East, laws treated men with regard to their status, their position, their standing in society, rather than as individuals and members of the community. So that it's the aristocracy, it's the priests, the landowners, the rulers, who always have advantage. No, we won't do it that way, Moses said. And Israel was required to show a deep concern for the welfare of everyone, rich
all poor.
Slaves were not to be kept in permanent bondage, and as you read, when somebody set the slave free, then the ex-owner was required to provide generously for him. And the poor? The employer was not to hold back daily pay. We can survive on weekly pay packets. They couldn't. As God said, or Moses said, they count on it. They set their heart on it. He's got a wife, 17 children, a budgery guard to feed. You cannot hold back his pay from him. And the wealthy, which we read, not allowed to refuse to lend simply because the year of release was near. Open your hand wide. If a garment was taken in pledge, some money's advanced on the strength of it, and the man is poor, then you give it to him back every night. He needs it to sleep in. And if you're a farmer and you happen at harvest to miss a sheaf, then you cannot go back and collect it. You're forbidden to go over the boughs of the olive tree a second time, or to glean in the vineyard after you've gathered the grapes the first time round. Whatever is missed must be left for the widow, the orphan, and the stranger. Underline that word, must be left. Words. Because I want you to note, and it struck me, moved me, that the poor in Israel were supported not as an act of charity, but an act of justice. It was their right to be supported. And there are many commands in that section which rest not so much on compassion for the poor, though God would have that in his people, but on their entitlement. And the fact that they were entitled to support enabled them to maintain their self-respect. They didn't need to grovel. There didn't need to be a beggar in Israel. They had the right to be supported. And you had to show respect for the home of the house of the poorest man in Israel. If you're a creditor, Moses said, and you've come to reclaim a pledge, you cannot cross his threshold. It's his castle, and you keep out, and he'll go in, and he'll fetch it for you. I'm not making it up, that's what he said. Respect for the individual. Well, how do you get people to do that then? Well, Moses said, it's an enormous privilege. Because you are actually having fellowship with God in his care for the poor and underprivileged. I quoted chapter 10. God loves the stranger. Therefore, you love the stranger. And one of the lovely insights into God's feelings for those who suffer is hidden away in one of the curses in chapter 27. Listen to this. Cursed is the one who makes the blind to wander off the road. That's the kind of God we got, Moses said. And that's how we should be. And there, in chapter 16, is verse 20. Literally it reads, justice, justice you shall follow. And in the land, justice would be done, and would be seen to be done. And Moses built in many legal safeguards. For instance, you do not act on hearsay. In chapter 13, some worthless characters. They've led the town into idolatry. Who said? Well, he did. Well, that's not good. What are you going to do? Moses says, you inquire. That's enough, I understand that. Never mind, he said, I know you understand it. Listen, you inquire, you search out. All right, I heard you the first time. I inquire, I search out, and investigate thoroughly. You have to keep on, yes, to get the point over. You don't listen to gossip. Have you heard about Well, I haven't heard about them. Thank you very much. I don't want to hear about them until the facts are established. And you required more than one witness before you would entertain charges against somebody. And Moses built in some very real deterrents to people lying and bearing false accusation against others. Because you'd have to, if it's proved false, you've got to pay whatever it was you were hoping to obtain. And if that happens to be a life, then you won't do it twice. Because the law demanded recompense. But it demanded proportionate recompense. Not over the top stuff. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. You can't exact any more than that. Just proportionate. Moses took a very serious view of crime. God did. But what you notice in that section is there's no cruelty. There's no infringement of a man's dignity, such as you meet in the other nations, the laws of the other lands around them, which encouraged facial mutilation, castration, merciless flogging. In Israel, you got to the 40th stroke, and you stopped. Now, of course, the Jews, play safe. They cut it down to 39. They could have gone to 40. They could not have gone to 41. God, Moses, wouldn't allow him. That brings us then to our blessings and curses, chapters 27 and 28. Because loyalty, or otherwise, to the Lord was no trifling matter. Now, you've got 12, I've got some statistics there, but what that hides is that in chapter 27, you've got 12 specific curses. Cursed be the one who does this and the one who does that. And then in chapter 18, you've got 6 blessings and 6 curses of a general nature. If you disobey God, then all these things will happen if you obey him that. Very serious issues at stake. I said over there that in the typical Hittite treaty, there were more curses than there were blessings. Well, that's true, as the statistics are there. But actually it's bigger than that, because when you finish the blessings in chapter 28, you then expand on it a bit, and that takes you 7 verses. Then you do the curses, and you expand on that a bit. That's 49 verses. So it's times 7. If the people disobey, Moses was saying, if the people disobey, then the land of promise will rapidly become the land of problems. And then the final section, down here. Now, to some extent, this is a summary. Okay, to read it, it's a summary of what's gone before. Now, on the one hand, there are several close parallels between Deuteronomy and the secular treaties. So I've got witnesses. I haven't given you them all here. There were actually 3 witnesses that Moses cited. There's the heaven and earth, which got the references. I won't talk about it. There's that great song, which God taught Moses. He didn't compose it. He composed the one in Exodus 15. But this is the song of Moses. Some people call it that. It's a bit of a misnomer, really. But it's a witness reference there. And also the book of the law. The reference, I should give it to you, so you don't want to. It's in chapter 31, verse 26. The book of the law itself was a witness. Regular public reading, reference here. Now, in the secular treaties, it's sometimes as short as 1 or 3 years. In Israel, it was every 7th year. It was the year of release. And when you hit the Feast of Tabernacles, then there was to be a public reading of the law every 7 years. And I don't know why. I'm going to give you my guess. The children were required to be present. And I would guess that from the time a child could understand what was being said and enter into it intelligently, if you do it every 7 years, then during every child's childhood, there would be at least one reading of that law and commitment to it. And then there's this depositing it, and Moses singled out the Levites who carried the ark and said to them, here it is, and you keep it alongside the ark. Now inside the ark, of course, were the tables of stone, but that's another story. There were a lot of parallels But on the other hand, there's a lot of material in here that's got no counterpart whatever in any treaty, any secular treaty. And that's hardly surprising, because much of chapter 29 and 30 are occupied with the future. And come as direct, specific prophecy. This is how it's worded. When, not if, when all these things are come on you, and you return to the Lord your God and obey his voice, then the Lord your God will turn your captivity and will gather you from all the nations and will do you good and multiply you above your fathers and will circumcise your heart to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. You understand? When this, then that's going to happen. Now who knows? Well, no Hittite king, no great king of Hattai would have known, but God knew. And this is why I would suggest that before we get into that section, I'm quoting beginning of chapter 30, before you get into that section, you've got the last verse of chapter 29. The secret, the hidden things, belong to the Lord our God. But the things which are revealed belong to us and our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. Now, you can see what Moses is saying. You may not understand all that I'm saying about things to come. Trying to get this lot together and work out what's going to happen in detail is beyond your wit. God knows. The secret things belong to him. Your business is to obey what you do understand. That section there. Well, that's it then. The book of Deuteronomy gives us the last utterances of the man Moses, who had put up for so long with all the sins and complaints of his people. And the whole book, big book, of annual covenant services for, I call them his followers, Methodists as they became. Well, we're in January, so it's probably appropriate for me to refer to it. I read through this service of Wesley's, a covenant service. Some of it's rather hot, but it ends with a frightening personal prayer. I'm not going to pray it. I can't pray it. But I'll tell you, this is how Mr. Wesley ended his covenant service. I am no longer my own, but yours. Put me to what you will. Put me to doing, put me to suffering. Let me be employed by you or laid aside for you, exalted for you or brought low for you. Let me be full, let me be empty. Let me have all things, let me have nothing. I freely and wholeheartedly yield all to your pleasure and disposal. Now that's a covenant we're signing up to for those who have the courage.